Chapter 9. Far-reaching discriminating awareness. The sage has spoken about all these branches for the sake of discriminating awareness. Therefore, generating discriminating awareness with the wish to pacify sufferings. Surface and deepest, these are accepted as being the two truths. The deepest aren't cognitive objects of the dualistic mind. The dualistic mind is spoken of in terms of the surface. In light of that, the world is seen to be of two types: yogis and common people. And regarding that, the world of common people is undermined by the yogi world. Through differences in their intelligence, yogis too are determined by progressively higher ones, by means of examples accepted by both and because. When not scrutinizing, both accept that causes function for the sake of the result. Functional phenomena are seen by the common world and conceptualized to be absolutely existent and not like an illusion. It's in this regard that there's dispute between the yogis and the common world. But even form and so on, as perceived by straightforward cognition itself, is established only by popular consensus and not by valid cognition. And that's false, like the popular consensus that what's clean and so forth is clean and so on. For the sake of causing the common world to enter, the guardian Buddha has taught that there are truly existent functional phenomena. Their actual nature, however, is that they aren't momentary things. Suppose, like the Sautantrikas, you objected, but it's supposed to contradict the common surface view. Well, surface truth asserted by yogis has no fault, and that's a seeing of their actual nature relative to the common world's view. Otherwise, their ascertainment of the uncleanliness of a woman's body, for instance, would be undermined by the common world. Furthermore, from triumphant ones who are like an illusion comes positive force, in the same way as if they actually were truly existent functional phenomena. Suppose you objected, but if a limited being were like an illusion, then how could he take birth once having died? Well, so long as conditions are gathered together, for that long an illusion lasts as well. And how could a limited being be truly existent merely because his continuity lasts longer? In murdering and so on, a person that is actually an illusion, there is no negative force since it hasn't a mind. But with someone having the type of illusion a mind actually is, positive and negative forces accrue. Because mantras and so forth lack the ability, they cannot produce an actual illusory mind. And even that illusory one that arises from varying conditions is of varying sorts, since nowhere is there one condition having the ability for producing all. Suppose you asked if, in deepest truth, someone were released in natural nirvana, and in surface truth were circling in samsara. Then, since Buddha as well would be circling in samsara, what use would there be with bodhisattva behavior? Well, even an illusion cannot be turned back unless the continuity of its conditions is cut. Yet, when the continuity of its conditions is cut, it doesn't arise even in surface truth. Suppose, like the Chittamatrins, you then asked, why even the deceptive awareness of it doesn't truly exist? By what is the illusion being focused on? Well, when the illusion itself doesn't externally exist according to you, then on what is it being focused? Suppose you answered, in actuality it exists as something else. It's an aspect of mind itself. Well, when mind itself is what the illusion actually is, then what's being seen by what? It's been said by the guardian for the world, in fact, mind cannot see mind. Just as the edge of a sword cannot cut itself, so it is with the mind. Suppose you responded, but it's just like how a candle flame perfectly illuminates itself as a phenomenon. Well, the flame of a candle isn't being illuminated, since it's not something that had been obscured by darkness. Suppose you replied, well, a blue object, for example, doesn't depend on something else for its being blue, as does a clear crystal. So like this, some things are seen that depend on other, and some that do not so depend. Well, when something is an example of non-blue, it can't make itself blue by itself. And what blue object can make itself blue by itself? Suppose you persisted, but as it's cognized by a cognition, it can be said, the candle flame is illuminating itself. Well, upon its being cognized by what can that statement be made? A mind is illuminating itself. And when it's never been seen by anyone, then discussing whether it's self-luminous or not self-luminous is meaningless, like the beautiful looks of the daughter of a barren woman. Suppose you insisted, but if reflexive awareness does not exist, then how does a consciousness come to be recalled? Well, a recollection comes about from a connection with another object that was experienced, like the poison from a rat. And suppose you persisted, but it could illuminate itself, because when endowed with other conditions, there's the seeing of others' minds. Well, a buried treasure vase that's seen from applying actualized magic eye lotion still wouldn't be the eye lotion itself. How something is seen, heard, or known is not being nullified in this at all. Here instead, conceptual cognition of it as truly existent, which has become the cause for suffering, is being turned back. Suppose you said, an illusion of an external object isn't different from the mind, yet it can't be conceived as non-different. Well, if it were a truly existent functional phenomena, how could it not be different? And if you said it's not different, it couldn't be a truly existent functional phenomenon. Just as an illusion, though not truly existent, can still be seen, so too is it with what does the seeing. Suppose you still objected, but samsara must have a truly existent functional phenomena as its support. Otherwise, it would be like space. Well, how could a non-phenomena come to have a function through its being supported on a truly existent functional one? And the mind, you asserted, would get reduced, in fact, to something existing alone by itself, accompanied by nothing. And when the mind would be naturally free of cognized objects, then everyone would be a thusly gone Buddha. And if that were the case, what benefit would there be in conceiving of mind only? Suppose you asked, even upon knowing the similarity of things with illusion, how does disturbing emotion turn back when it's the case that lust for an illusory woman can arise even in the one who conjured her? Well, that happens because the conjurer hasn't rid himself yet of the habit for disturbing emotion toward knowable things. And so, when he sees her, his habit for voidness is still weak in force. However, by habituating himself to the habit of voidness, he'll rid himself of the habit of cognizing phenomena as truly existent. Then, by habituating himself with no such thing, he'll later come to rid himself even of cognizing that. When a truly existent functional phenomenon, which is conceived as not existing, is no longer taken as the mental aim, then lacking a support, how can the non-functional phenomena of its non-true existence remain before the dualistic mind? When neither a truly existent functional phenomena nor the non-functional one of its non-true existence remains before the dualistic mind, then, since the other alternatives cannot be the case, there's full pacification into a state without mental aim at the impossible. Then, just as a wish-fulfilling gem and a wish-granting tree fulfill all wishes, likewise, through the power of disciples to be tamed and of prayers, the enlightening form of a triumphant one appears. For example, just as when a Garudika healer has passed away after actualizing a wooden healing post, it can still pacify poison and the like, even when a long time's expired since his passing. So, too, when a bodhisattva has passed into nirvana, after actualizing the healing post body of a triumphant one, in accord with bodhisattva behavior, it can still perform all that's to be done. Suppose you asked, how can offerings be made to something lacking a mind having results? Well, why? Because whether he's still here or has already passed into nirvana, it's been proclaimed as being the same. According to scriptural authority, results are there, whether from the surface viewpoint or that of actuality. It's like, for example, how you'd say that offerings made to a truly existent Buddha has results. Suppose, like the Hinayanists, you then objected, but since liberation comes from seeing the Four Noble Truths, what's the use of seeing voidness? Well, why? Because from scriptural authority, it's been proclaimed that without this path, there's no purified state. Suppose you then objected, but Mahayana's not established as valid. Well, how can your scriptures be established? If you answered because they're established for both parties, well, they weren't established for you from the start. Any criterion that would give confidence in them would equally apply to the Mahayana ones too. And if acceptance by two different parties could make something true, then the Vedas and so on would also become true. Suppose you argued it's because the Mahayana ones are disputed. Well, because your scriptures are disputed by non-Buddhists, and some other sections within your scriptures by yourselves and others, they'd have to be discarded too. Suppose you said, but the teachings of the Four Noble Truths are the root of the absolute monkhood of arhats. Well, even absolute monkhood itself is on difficult ground, since the nirvana of a mind still aimed at the impossible is on difficult grounds. Suppose you replied, but they've become liberated because they've rid themselves of disturbing emotion. Well, that would need to have happened immediately upon that. However, it seemed that despite their lacking disturbing emotion, they're still under the power of karma. Suppose you then said, but it's definite that they don't have, still to some extent, craving as a condition for obtaining rebirth. Well, why couldn't it be that a craving that's not with disturbing emotion is still existing in them, while still with bewilderment about all? Through the circumstance of feeling, there's craving, and feeling still exists in them as well. So a mind still having an aim at the impossible will come to be settled on one or another. A mind that's parted from voidness may block it, but it'll rise once again, as with a trance that lacks distinguishing. Therefore, one needs to meditate on voidness. So again, if you accept as spoken by the Buddha any speech that's made it down into the sutras, then why not accept the Mahayana, which for the most part are equivalent to your sutras? If, because of one exception, all would become corrupt, then why, because of one equivalence to your sutras, wouldn't all have been spoken by the Buddha? And who would consider unacceptable some speech, the depths of which even Mahakaishapa and the like couldn't fathom, simply because you can't understand it? After all, the fruit of realizing voidness is this, through freedom from the extremes of attachment and fear, being able to stay in samsara for the sake of those suffering from being bewildered, as it's like this, derision's improper, in the direction of voidness. Therefore, without indecisively wavering, meditate, please, on voidness. Voidness is the opponent for the darkness of the emotional and cognitive obscurations, so how can someone wishing for omniscience quickly not meditate upon it? Cognizing phenomena as truly existence gives rise to suffering. Generate fear for that. But realizing voidness pacifies suffering, so why does fear generate for that? Go ahead and be afraid of whatever. If there were something called a me, but as there's nothing that is a me, then whose fear will it be? Teeth, hair, or nails are not a me, nor am I bones or blood. I'm neither mucus nor phlegm, nor am I lymph or pus. I am not fat nor sweat, nor am I even lungs or liver. I'm not any of the other inner organs at all, nor am I feces or urine. Flesh or skin is not a me, nor am I temperature or energy wind. In no way am I ever a bodily whole, nor are the six types of consciousness a me. And if a person were a permanent cognizer, as Samkhya asserts, and of a sound, the sound would be cognized all of the time. But when bereft of something it cognizes, what does it know by means of which it could be called a cognizer? If it could be a cognizer without cognizing something, then absurdly a stick would also be a cognizer. Therefore, it's certain that without something nearby that it's cognizing, it can't be a cognition. Suppose you said, it itself is then cognizing a sight. Well, why doesn't it also hear at that time? If you answered, because the sound's not nearby, well, then it's no longer a cognizer of it. How can something have the natural guise of the cognizer of a sound become the cognizer of a sight? One can be labeled a father and a son, but not as his absolute nature. And it's like this because balanced sattva pleasure, rajas pain, and tamas neutral sensation, as the absolute nature, is neither a son nor is it a father. And because that cognizer of a sight has never been seen, with the fundamental nature connected with the cognizer of a sound, suppose you persisted like a dancer, it's still itself, but seen with another mode of guise. Well then, it wouldn't be static. And suppose you clarified, it's still itself, but its fundamental nature is in another mode. Well, its oneness is one without any precedent. Suppose you explained, but its assorted modes of guise are not true. Then describe, please, its own innate natural guise. Suppose you answered, its being a cognizer. Well, then, absurdly, it would follow that all persons are one. Further, what has intention and what lacks intention, those two would, in fact, become one thing, because their existence is the same, and if individualities were contrary to fact, then what could be their shared support? Furthermore, something lacking intention cannot be a self, as Nyaya Vaishika asserts, because of its nature of lack of intention, just like a vase and other such things. Now suppose you claimed it's cognizant because of a conjunction with an intention, then it absurdly follows that this non-cognizant self has perished. And if the self were in fact unchanging, what could have been done to it through a connection with an intention? Moreover, space is non-cognizant and inert like that, so it as well could become a self. Suppose you both then objected, but without the true existence of a static self, the connection between behavioral cause and effect would be unreasonable, since if it perished after having done an action, then whose action would it have been? Well, since it's established for both of us that the action and result have a different basis, and that the self has an inactive role in this, isn't it useless to debate on this point? Someone providing a causal action and conjoined with its result, this has never been seen as an existent thing. It's in reliance on the unity of a continuum that it is taught. Only the agent can be the experiencer of the results. The already past and the not yet arisen minds are not the self, since they don't exist now. And well, if the presently arising mind were the self, when it perishes, there would in fact be no self. For example, when the trunk of a plantain tree is split into parts, nothing is found. Likewise, when searched for with discerning analysis, a self isn't found as an absolute thing. Suppose you asked if a limited being didn't exist, toward whom could there be compassion? Well, it would be toward one who was conceptually labeled by a bewildered mind that had committed itself to the goal of its fruit. Suppose you then asked, whose fruit would it be if there were no limited being? Well, that's true, it's accepted that the wish is due to bewilderment. Yet for the sake of pacifying suffering completely, bewilderment about the fruit is not turned back. Because of bewilderment about the self, the cause of suffering, self-inflation, increases. Suppose you said, but there's no turning back from that. Well, best is meditation on the lack of an impossible self. A body is neither the feet nor the calves, nor is a body the thighs or the hips. The belly or the back is not a body. Neither is a body the chest or the arms. The sides of the torso or the hands are not a body, nor is a body the armpits or the shoulders. The inner organs are not it, and neither is a body the head or also the neck. And so what alternative could a body be here? If this body were located with a portion in all these, then although the parts are located in the parts, where is it itself located? And if a body itself, in its entirety, were located everywhere, in the hands and so forth, there would be as many bodies as there were hands and so on. As a body's not located outside or inside the parts, how could a body exist in terms of the hands and so forth as their possessor? And as it's also not a possessor separate from the hands and so on, how could it possibly be truly existent? Thus, a body's not truly existent, but because of bewilderment in terms of the hands and so forth, a dualistic mind arises of a body. It's like the dualistic mind that arises of a man in terms of a scarecrow, by its feature of having been set up in its shape. For as long as the conditions are assembled, the body of a scarecrow is seen as a man. Likewise, for as long as there are hands and so on, a body is seen in terms of them. Similarly, because of its being a composite of fingers, which one could be a hand? The same with that finger as well, because of its being a composite of joints, and a joint as well, from the breakdown into its own parts, and a part as well, through a breakdown into particles, and that particle as well, because of directional divisions, and a directional division too, because of its being without findable parts, like space, consequently even particles don't truly exist. Therefore, what discerning person would be attached to a bodily form which is like a dream? And when, like that, a body doesn't truly exist, then what's a male and what's a female? If suffering existed by absolute nature, how is it that it doesn't undermine experiencing pleasures? And if happiness, for those tormented by grief and the like, were a tasty dish or such things, why doesn't it make them delighted? Suppose you answered, it's not experienced, because it's outshone by something that's more intense. Well, how can something not in the nature of an experience still be something in the category of a feeling? Suppose you replied, couldn't it still be suffering, but in a subtle state, when its gross level has been displaced? Well, then, you could also say that, other than that, it was a slight level of joy, and then, absurdly, its subtle state would be one of that, too. Suppose you said, but at the arising of incompatible conditions, there's the non-arising of suffering. Well, doesn't that come down to establishing that a feeling is merely something hung on by a conceptual thought? Because of just that, this discerning analysis needs to be meditated as its opponent. The stability of mind that grows from the field of examining is the food of the yogis. If there's a gap between a cognitive sensor and its object, where could the meeting of the two occur? And if there's no gap, they'd be a fused unity, so the meeting would be of what with what. Yet there can't be penetration of a particle by a particle. They've no empty space, and they're of uniform size. When there's no penetration, there's no commingling, and when there's no commingling, there's no meeting. Moreover, for something that's partless, how could what might be called a meeting properly take place if a meeting and being partless can be observed together? Then show it, please! For a consciousness which is immaterial, a meeting is an impossibility. That's so for a composite as well, because it doesn't truly exist, as has been discerningly analyzed before. And so like that, when contact doesn't truly exist, from what does a feeling arise? And for what reason, then, is there all this trouble? For whom and from what could injury come? And when there's no truly existent one that feels, and feeling as well doesn't truly exist, then seeing this situation, oh craving, why don't you turn yourself back? Nevertheless, something can be seen and also be touched through what has the nature of a dream or an illusion. Further, a feeling cannot be perceived by a mind from arising simultaneously with it. And through a previous one can be remembered by one that arises later. It can't be experienced by it. In short, a feeling can't experience its own self, and it can't be experienced by something else. As there's no truly existent one that feels, then feeling cannot exist absolutely. So in this bundle that lacks a true self, who can be injured by it? A mind not situated in cognitive centers, in sights, and so on, nor in the space in between. A mind isn't inside, nor is it outside, nor can it be found, in fact, anywhere else. Something that isn't the body nor something else, neither commingled nor separate in any way, isn't anything truly existent at all. Because of that, limited beings are naturally released in parinirvana. If the cognition of something were prior to what is cognized, then what's it to be aimed at for its arising to occur? And if a cognition were simultaneous with that which is cognized, still, what's it to be aimed at for its arising to occur? Yet if it occurred after what is cognized, then from what did the cognition of it arise? Similarly, it can't be determined that there's a truly existing arising of any phenomena. Suppose you objected, but if it were like that, then surface true things wouldn't exist at all. And so, how, in this case, could there be the two truths? Moreover, if they were being projected by others as veiling surface truths, then how could there be someone with a limited mind unveiled and released with nirvana? Well, this would be the deceptive conception of other limited minds, but that isn't the surface truth from its own point of view. What's ascertained afterwards, it still exists, and if not, then surface truth becomes something that doesn't exist. And so, what's conceptually examining and what's conceptually examined, the two of them are dependently supported, one by the other, and it's by being dependently supported by what's in accord with popular consensus that all analytical discernment is expressed. But when you object, one needs to analytically discern with a discernment that which has analytically discerned, then there would be an infinite regress for that discernment, because of its need also to be analytically discerned. Well, when what's analytically discerned is being discerned, a supporting basis for that discernment doesn't exist, and because of its being without a supporting basis, it doesn't arise, that's called its natural release in nirvana. And as for the likes of someone for whom these two are truly existent, he indeed is on very difficult grounds. Because if it's from the power of a cognition that an object's established, then what supporting basis is there for establishing the true existence of the cognition? And if it's from the power of what's cognized that a cognition is established, then what supporting basis is there for establishing the true existence of what's cognized? On the other hand, if their existence is established by the power of each other, then the non-true existence of both would be the case. For example, if without a child someone is not a father, then from whom can it arise that someone is a child? Because in the absence of a child there can be no father. Similar to that is the non-true existence of these two. Suppose you asked, a sprout grows from a seed, and just as the true existence of the seed is indicated by it, why, by the arising of a cognition from what's cognized, can't its true existence also be included? Well, when it's from a cognition different from the sprout, that it can be concluded that a seed exists, what can it be from by means of which the true existence of a cognition cognizing something it cognizes can be concluded? Charvakas, please. From straightforward cognition, the common world in fact sees for itself everything causal. After all, a diversity of plants, lotus stalks, and the like grow by means of a diversity of causes. Suppose you ask, by what has the diversity of causes been made? Well, from a diversity of previous causes. And suppose you ask further, because of what does a cause have the ability to give rise to an effect? Well, it's from the power of previous causes. If, as Nyava Vaisheshika asserts, the powerful Lord Ishvara were the cause of the world, so tell me, what is Ishvara in fact? If you said the elements, then so be it, but why all the fuss over merely a name? However, earth and the rest are multi-part, non-static, inert, and not divine. They are things to be walked over and unclean. So that can't be the powerful Lord Ishvara. Ishvara can't be space, because that's inert. He can't be the self, since that's been refuted before. And even if you said the nature of being a creator is in reference to someone inconceivable, well, then, what's the use of talking about something that's inconceivable? And what could it be that he wished to create? The self. Well, aren't that the earth element and the rest, and Ishvara supposed to be eternal by nature? Moreover, the arising of cognition from cognizable objects is without a beginning, as is happiness and suffering from karma. So tell me, what's been created by him? And if there's no beginning to the cause, how could there be a first instance of its effect? And why doesn't he always create when he doesn't depend on anything else? There's nothing else existing not created by him, so what is it on which he depends to create? If what he depends on is a gathering of conditions, then again the powerful Lord Ishvara would become not the cause, for when they've gathered, he'd lack the power not to create, and in their absence, he'd lack the power to create. And if the Lord Ishvara must create when not wanting to, it absurdly follows that he's under the power of something else. And if it's when wanting to, he's under the power of want. So where's the power of the powerful Lord who's creating? Those Mimamsakas who assert static particles as the creator have already been turned back before, while the Samkhyas assert static primal matter as the cause of the world. For them, the universal constituents known as sattva pleasure, rajas pain, and tamas neutral sensation, abiding not in imbalance, are called primal matter, while their imbalance is said to be the world. But it's illogical for a partless unity to be something threefold by nature, and therefore it doesn't exist. Likewise, the universal constituents can't be truly existent because each of them too has three aspects. And in the absence of the universal constituents, the true existence of sound and the rest becomes far-fetched. Moreover, it's impossible for pleasure and so on to exist in non-conscious clothing and the likes. Suppose you said, functional phenomena exist in the natural guise of their cause. Well, haven't functional phenomena already been analyzed? In any case, the causes for you are pleasure and so on themselves, but cotton clothing and the likes don't arise from that at all, and if pleasure and so on were to exist from cotton clothing and the likes, then from their absence, pleasure and so on wouldn't exist. Moreover, a static state of pleasure and so on has never been focused upon. If manifest pleasure and so on were truly existent statically, why isn't their experience always perceived? Suppose you said the sensation itself goes to a subtle unmanifest state. Well, how can it be both gross and subtle? Since it would have become subtle and unmanifest after having left its gross manifest state, its gross and subtle states are non-static. So why not accept the non-staticness like that of all functional phenomena? And if its gross manifest state were no different from pleasure itself, then the non-staticness of pleasure is obvious. Suppose you asserted but something totally non-existent in the cause couldn't be produced because of its being non-existent. Well, then production of something non-existent as a manifest object would be the self-contradiction into which you're positioned, although you don't want it. And if the effect were positioned in the cause, then a consumer of food would be an eater of excrement. And for the price of cotton clothing, cotton seed could be bought and worn instead. Suppose you said, although common people don't see it, because of bewilderment, precisely that is the position established by Kapila, the knower of reality. Well, cognition of that must also exist in common people, so why isn't it seen? Suppose you answered that lies in common people's not being valid cognizers for that. Well, what they see as manifest then would also not be true. Suppose you retorted, but you too assert that a valid cognizer for the common world is not a valid cognizer for deepest truth. And if that's the case, then wouldn't what was validly cognized by it also become false, and therefore in actuality meditation on the voidness of functional phenomena by it become incorrect? Well, yes, but when functional phenomena labeled and conceptually analyzed are not contacted, the non-functional phenomena of their non-true existence would also not be grasped. Therefore, concerning any truly existent functional phenomena that's false, the falsehood of the non-functional phenomenon of its non-true existence would be obvious. Thus, upon the death of a son in a dream, the conceptual thought that he doesn't exist stops the arising of the conceptual thought that he does exist, and yet it is false. Therefore, with discerning analysis like this, nothing exists that's from no cause at all, or that's sitting there, fixed in conditions, whether separate ones or combined. Yet nothing has come from something else, and nothing remains, and nothing goes. So, anything taken as truly existent by bewildered minds, what difference does it have from an illusion? So, examine something emanated by illusion and something emanated by causes. Where does it come from? Where does it go? How can there be true existence in some virtual object like a reflection, which is seen only in conjunction with something else and which doesn't exist when that's absent? For a functional phenomena that was truly existing, what need would there be for a cause? Then again, if something were truly not existing, what need would there be for a cause? There can be no transformation of a non-phenomena, even by means of 100 million causes. How can something in that state become a functional phenomena, but what else could come into functional existence? If it isn't a functional phenomena at the time of being a non-phenomena, when will it come to exist as a functional phenomenon? But without its functional existence coming to arise, it won't leave being a non-phenomenon. Without leaving being a non-phenomenon, no occasion will occur for it coming to exist as a functional phenomenon, and a functional phenomenon cannot go to a state of non-functionality, because it would absurdly follow that it had a bipolar true nature. In that way, a cessation doesn't truly exist, and the arising of phenomena doesn't truly exist either. Thus, this entire world always has been non-truly arising and non-truly ceasing. Therefore, wandering beings resemble a dream. Upon discerning analysis, they're the same as a plantain tree. Whether they're released from nirvana or not released, there's no difference in their actual way of existing. From all phenomena devoid in that way, what is there that would have been received? What is there that would have been taken away? Who is there who will become shown respect or contempt, and by whom? What is there from which there's pleasure or pain? What is there to be disliked or liked? What craving is there that's searching for an actual findable nature? And what is it for that there's craving? Upon discerning analysis, what world of living beings is there? Who is possibly there that will die from here? Who is there that'll come to exist? Who is there that has existed? Who is there that is a relative? Who is there that is a friend? And who is there whose friend it is? Those of my type, understand please that all of them are like space, but those wishing for happiness for a self get agitated and overexcited through fights and festivities as the cause, and then, though the resulting distress and overexertion, disheartening disputes and knifings and stabbings of each other, they pass their lives with tremendous difficulties through their negative acts, and despite coming and coming to the better rebirth states and experiencing manifold pleasures, they fall after death to the worst rebirth states and unbearable sufferings for a very long time. In compulsive existence, cliffs to fall from are aplenty, and there it's like this when actuality is not known. And since this and what's there in fact contradict one another, in compulsive existence it's not like this when actuality is known. There, too, there are incomparable violent oceans of suffering beyond any end. There, like that, there little strength. There, as well, there's little lifespan. There, as well, with activities for longevity and health, with hunger and exhaustion, with sleep and calamities, and likewise with fruitless company with infantile people. A lifetime passes quickly and in vain. Yet analytical discernment is so difficult to gain, so there as well, where there's a means for turning back chronic distraction. There, as well, demonic forces working hard to bring about a fall to the most awful rebirth states. There, because there's a profusion of false paths, indecisively wavering is so hard to transcend, and with the difficulty of gaining a respite again, and the advent of a Buddha even more difficult to gain, and the rapids of disturbing emotion so difficult to get out of, alas, suffering will just go on and on. Oh dear, it's really fit to feel sad about those who are caught in a rapids of suffering, and who fail to see their own terrible situations, although they're in extremely terrible states. For example, just as some people abluting and abluting would jump into fire again and again, and though in extremely terrible states proudly consider themselves in extremely wonderful situations, likewise there are those who frolic about, fooling around as if there weren't old age and death. But first they'll be made to lose their lives, and then comes an unbearable fall to a worse rebirth state. Oh, when shall I come to bring peace to those tortured by the fires of suffering like that? With a rain of my build-up of happiness pouring forth from the clouds of my positive force. Oh, when shall I respectfully build up a network of positive force in a manner of no mental aim at impossible existence, and then teach voidness to those who've been ruined by such mental aim?